So what are we doing? What have we done? Well, let's start with this. Augustine, in his work on Christian teaching, talks about two things that all interpretation of Scripture depends on. First thing is the process of discovering what we need to learn. And the second thing is the process of presenting what we have learned. And that's what we're going to talk about today. It's the second half of what Augustine said. We want to get the passage right. That's what a lot of the instructional sessions and what we've been talking about this past week. But we also want to get it across. And what's helpful is that your work in getting it across should be driven by your work in the text. There is a direct correlation between both. In fact, sometimes those of us who maybe in the past or maybe in the present, we separate too much the work in the text and the work of the sermon, and that gets us into trouble, right? So we want to show the correlation between what we've been doing all the way up until this point, all of the different instructions, and, okay, how do you put together a sermon? So what have we done so far? We've done this. We've talked about the text. There's a message to them. Then we want to understand this message to them then in light of the death and resurrection of Jesus. And so we want to do careful, good theological reflection. And that's when we're ready to apply. That's when we're ready to do homiletics. That's when we're ready to put together a sermon. We've talked about structure, the importance of the structure of the text. We've talked about context. We've talked about the melodic line, which is really an element of context, right? It's the context of the whole book. You want to consider that. And we've talked about, of course, making good gospel connections. The aspect of the gospel in view, but then also the use of the gospel, especially in the epistles. Those are two important questions to ask. So this is what we've done. And again, this is what we're going to focus on today in the next 45 minutes or so. And for preachers, there is a tension between the text and today. And there's a tension between the text and today for a whole host of reasons. The first one being the culture of the text and the culture of today obviously is very different. So you're trying to build some bridges between the text and today. But there's other things that call, kind of press on us and push us sometimes to either step into our worlds too much and we kind of leave behind some of the text, or perhaps the opposite of that. We pull in too much of the text in the sense of maybe a running commentary sermon, and we've forgotten the people right in front of us, right? So I want to give you five A's. I think Jim has added a sixth A. Maybe there's a seventh A. But let me give you five A's that can help us do this, and we're going to zoom in on one of these A's. So how do we do this? We want to consider the audience. We want to apply our passage in specific ways. We want to adorn our passage with good illustrations. We want to arrange our passage in such a way that our people will receive it well. And what we're going to talk about today is we want to make an argument. And in some ways, I'm going to talk mostly about argument, but we're also going to talk a little bit about arrangement, because arrangement and argument are very closely tied, because, especially in the epistles, when Paul is making an argument, the way he makes that argument is to, the way he advances that argument is through particular points, right? And so argument and arrangement are very closely tied, and I'm going to try to make that case here in a second. Here's the principle as we're thinking about argument, okay? You can jot this down. You must make an argument for the sake of persuasion. You must make an argument for the sake of persuasion. Here's the drawing. It's a big exclamation mark, and it means you got to make a point. You got to have something to argue. I want you to listen to these verses. This is 2 Corinthians 5, verse 11. If you want to turn there, you can do that. Therefore, knowing the fear of the Lord, we persuade others. Real simple. Therefore, knowing the fear of the Lord, we persuade others. But what we are, is known to God, and I hope it is known also to your conscience. So Paul was unabashed in his desire to persuade. And notice the logic of this verse. Therefore, knowing the fear of the Lord, we persuade. So given what's at stake, given with whom we deal with, this isn't an option, in other words. We persuade. Open up to Acts 17. Acts 17, Paul in Thessalonica. Just want to quickly show you a couple things about this in the book of Acts. So we're thinking about how did the apostles approach their teaching ministry? Acts 17, verse 1 says, now when they had passed through Amphipolis, I didn't practice thinking about how to say that, and this other city, they came to Thessalonica, that one I know, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. Here we are, verse 2. And Paul went in, as was his custom, and on three Sabbath days he reasoned with them from the Scriptures. What does that mean? What does that look like? Well, he explained and proved that it was necessary for the Christ to suffer and to rise from the dead. And saying, this Jesus whom I proclaim to you is the Christ. Now notice those words. He reasoned with them from the Scriptures. He was explaining and proving that it was necessary for Christ, for the Christ to suffer and to rise from the dead. He was proclaiming to them about the Christ. If you look further into chapter 17 and his witness in Athens, if you look in chapter 18, his witness in Corinth, if you look further in chapter 18, in his witness in Ephesus, the same words are used. Reasoning, persuading, proving, explaining, and proclaiming. So, what can we take from this? It is important to make an argument when we proclaim Jesus from the Scriptures. You should not be merely articulating something, a string of facts, running commentary on the passage. Rather, you need to be arguing for something, towards something. Speaking is persuasion. I'm trying to persuade you of something right now. Now, how do we do this? Well, there's three things that you kind of discover in the exegetical process that relate to the argument, okay? So the first thing is, and this is right from our sheets, there's the argument of the author himself. So the primary claim of the text, okay? This is obviously extremely important. Now, I don't want you to confuse this with big idea preaching. I think that's an insufficient way to describe the text. It's not just kind of a big idea. We need to recognize the text is making a claim, an argument. Paul is making an argument in every paragraph of Ephesians. That's the first thing we need to do. We need to recognize that. That's why on your sheet, I think it's what, question 4 or 5, something like that, it says, what is the author's argument? That's where we start, right? This is a huge task. You got to put a lot of time into this, right? The second thing is, so that's the first thing you got to do. The second thing is you're working towards what is the argument for today. That's what we're working towards. The second thing you want to do is identify the structure, the development of the text. How does your text develop that claim, develop that argument, advance the purpose that the Apostle Paul has? So in the epistles, this is, of course, more obvious than other genres, right? Paul's teaching is argumentative. And so there's this interplay between argument, the author's arguments, and the author's structure. And so even as we're looking at, when you're working on structure, and that question says emphasis, what you're doing there is you're pulling out a provisional claim or argument based on the structure. And it's provisional because the rest of your work is going to enhance and refine and strengthen that claim, right? So that's why it's good to look at the structure as you're thinking, okay, what is the author's main claim? Okay, so what is the third thing? As we're kind of studying the text, we're still kind of looking at this first vertical line. The third thing is you're looking for significant exegetical observations. Okay? So the text has hundreds of properties, right? Some of them are lexical or grammatical or contextual in nature. And if you're reading a good commentary, that's what you're seeing. A good commentary is going to hit on all of those kinds of things. But you, as the preacher, you need to identify the hot spots. You got to choose the ones that are going to contribute to the primary argument that the author is trying to make. Okay, so this is really important. This is where I'm going to talk about this more later, but you're going to leave tons of stuff on the cutting room floor. You have to. So this is what we're doing. This is kind of a summary of kind of the work that we've talked about already. But what I want you to see is how this folds into the argument that we have to make towards our audience. Okay. So what about our arguments? Well, let's make some comments on this first. There's a one-to-one correspondence between the author's arguments and your sermon's arguments. It's maybe the most important thing I'll say in this lesson. There's a one-to-one correspondence between the primary claim of Paul in Ephesians 1, 3 through 14, let's say, and your sermon on that particular passage. The claim of the text ought to be the claim of your sermon. Your homiletical proposition ought to capture the primary claim and proposition of your text. You could say it 100 different ways, but I want you to hear that. It needs to be very clear. This is where we get our definition for preaching, expository preaching. The sermon's content and the sermon's intent is not just informed loosely, but rather controlled by the content and the intent of the passage. Okay, so that's where we start, but we have to acknowledge that our argument for us today, for your people, is going to be a little different, perhaps. The wording might be a little different. So how do you get at that? You need to take the author's arguments and understand it in both its context and the gospel, but then you need to re-articulate that argument for us today, for your people, for the 21st century, right? That's what we're getting at. That's what we're trying to work towards. So you might state the argument for your people. This is helpful to do in a multiple ways. So once you've grasped the argument of the author, once you've done all of your other work, and you're trying to work towards this, the single sentence that's going to capture this passage for your people, what I'd encourage you to do is to write that in 10 or 15 different ways. Give it lots of different variations and abbreviations, right? So you can write the full statement. You can write it in short, in a shorter version of that. You can expand it. You can write it in an expansive way. But it's really important that you write it in multiple ways. That's going to actually strengthen your sermon because you're going to be saying it differently throughout your sermon. So that's not just wasted time. Here's another way of approaching argument. You might state the argument for your people with two audiences in mind. First of all, the Christian audience. So that might drive at comfort and exhortation and challenge. But then you also might state your argument with the non-Christian mind, right? So this drives at maybe evangelistic or apologetical concerns, which anticipates objections, right? So you want to do both of those. That's very helpful, I think. Here's another encouragement for you guys. I already talked about that, I guess. Finding multiple articulations. I already mentioned that. So let me ask you guys a question. How might you or how do you use your arguments in your sermon? In your actual sermon, how might you use it? How do you use it? What do you guys think? Yeah. So this is what we do typically, probably 90% of our sermons or more. We state it at the front end of the sermon to make things clear, to give our people an anchor, which will hopefully hold them as we carry on. So that's one way to do it. Okay. What are some other? Repeat it at the end. Okay. What else? Yes. Yes. Exactly. That's very good. Yep. Any other ways of how this particular statement gets played out in your sermon? Yep. Excellent. Yeah, so this is the governing, this is what governs your sermon, right? And so this is the thing that will filter everything else out, all of the things that maybe are really interesting but ought not be in the sermon. So that's really helpful. Yeah, so the argument is a signpost, and I think depending on the way you use it, if you use it at the beginning, it kind of points the whole congregation in the direction that the sermon is going to go in. So this is where we're going. This is what we're going to be doing. And so the experience of listening to a sermon should be the experience of saying, hey, we're going in this way, and then you get to the end of the sermon and the preacher says, see, I told you so. Because you've shown them, you've proven to them that particular statement by working through the text. So this is really, really important. We act in some ways like a tour guide. So brothers, this is a huge task. I think I was in conversation with Ryan about this last night, and I think, Ryan, you said that after the three-week intensive that you did, one of the things that you worked on really hard is crafting and clarifying this argument and making it very clear, and you put a lot of time into just this. Is that correct? Yeah. And so this is hard work, but this is really, really important, good work. And so you want to make your homiletical argument memorable and interesting and concise and pithy, right? Because your audience is going to be hopefully captured to it. So there's science to it, as we've just talked through. There's also a little art to it, and that's okay. Okay. Now, the second step is we're thinking about, okay, we've gotten this argument. Now, what about the sermon outline? Well, I've already said it before, but I'm going to say it again. How does Paul argue for his claim in this text? Well, there's a flow to his argument. There's a development of his points. He's advancing his claim by making other points, right? So you want to recognize those points, and that's what we're doing in the structural work. And once again, here's another important sentence. There ought to be a one-to-one correspondence between your exegetical structure and your sermon structure. There ought to be a one-to-one correspondence between your exegetical structure and your sermon structure. In fact, it's good to use the language of the text. It's okay to do that. It's important to do that. And also to make it memorable. So you can use the language of the text, but then you can also, be a little creative to make it a little bit more memorable, perhaps. Now, this is not a hard and fast rule, but I think it's important for us to try to respect how the author presents his argument in the text, right? It's not just the content and the argument that is divinely inspired by the Spirit. It's the organization of that content and the argument that is divinely inspired by the Spirit, right? It's the manner in which it's being presented. So we want to honor the manner in which it's being presented in our preaching. Now, what's the value here? What's the value here for the preacher as well as for the congregation if we do this kind of work, if we're committed in this manner? What do you guys think? What's the value? Yes. Excellent. This is like number one on the list, right? Every day you guys preach in the pulpit, you are teaching your people how to read their Bibles. If you do it well, they're going to do it well. If you do it poorly, you're discipling them to read their Bibles in a way that's not going to be helpful. What are some other values for being committed to this kind of approach? Yeah. Yeah. Amen. Good. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. Excellent. Other thoughts? Yeah. That's right. Yeah. There's practical value for the preacher, like we don't need to come up with new points. What are the points of your sermon? It's the points of your exegetical outline, essentially, right? And so there's something there that you don't have to work at. It actually saves you some time. Maybe you should put that time that you would have used for that into creating and crafting your arguments. And so everything in your sermon, one of the brothers just said this, everything in your sermon to the smallest moments should be communicating to advance your arguments. That's really important. So as you're preaching, as you're putting together your notes, your manuscript or whatever, test every part of the sermon. Okay, so this might be Friday afternoon work or Saturday afternoon work for some of us. Be ruthless. Be okay with leaving stuff on the cutting room floor. We're going to do that a lot. In fact, in my sermon yesterday, I had this great little excursus on 1 Corinthians 13. I mean, it was going to be so good. I was so excited to share it. And then I looked at it and I'm like, this is more me trying to say something than what the text. This is not helping expose more in the text. So I just said, okay, I got to cut this out. It's really cool, though. It's really cool. But we have to be okay with doing that. Something that another pastor has told me is always preach close to the most recent point that you have made. Does that make sense? Stay close to the current level of organization. So if you're in point two, stay close to that, which obviously reflects the main argument, right? So stay close to the current level of organization. Don't wander. You know, if any of us were preaching, this is a helpful, we should do this. This might be a good Simeon Trust exercise. No, it would be horrible, actually. But if any of us were preaching and someone pushed the pause button in the middle of your sermon and asked, hey, how is this advancing your argument? You should be able to be like, okay, this is exactly how. Or it should be clear to everybody listening. Imagine if we did that on some of our sermons, right? Maybe some of us are telling a funny story and you're more interested in engaging or hooking in the congregation in that moment because you know you've just kind of developed a more theologically intricate point and you're thinking, man, I got to say something that's going to pull them in. I've done that before. So we just have to be clear, careful with that. Okay, let's practice a little bit. Open up to Philippians chapter 2. Philippians chapter 2. Okay, and let's work on this passage together. We're going to do some work in Ephesians later, but Philippians chapter 2, I wanted to look at a familiar passage, hopefully familiar to you. And let's do some quick structural work and quick work on the author's arguments, and then we're going to get into work on our own argument and our own sermon outline, okay? So let's see, who's got a loud voice? You want to stand up and read this passage for us, brother? 2, 1 through 11. Okay, brothers, I said we're going to do this together, so let's do this together. What is the structure of this passage? Okay, where do you see Christ descended? Okay, so that's kind of in the middle of the section. Where does he start? What's the first movement in this passage? Yeah. Okay. Okay. Okay, what do we see in those first few verses? How might we combine that into a point? Yeah, go ahead. Okay, interesting. What they are to do, what Christ did, what the Father did. Yeah, good. Yeah, call to unity. How many verses would you put that in? Okay. You guys agree with that? 1 through 4? Anybody want to push on that? So it seems like 1 and 2 are speaking of things that are true, he's using that for the purpose of motivating them towards the, whoa, I keep doing this. Go over here. And I think the purpose of 1 and 2 is to motivate for his exhortations in 3 and 4. Would you guys agree with that? Disagree? Okay. All right, let's just go with that one. What do you see in the next few verses? What's the next movement in this passage? Yep. 5 through 11, be humble like Jesus. Okay. Okay. You guys agree with that? Disagree? Okay. Have the mind of Christ among yourself. It's implied by be humble like Jesus, but okay. So perhaps we could use the phrase, or we could change around the phrasing a little bit. Okay. Yep. So verse 9 through 11, is that right? Did I get that right? Is exaltation. Yep. And this is, we're getting back to what you said. So verse 6 through 8 is he descended, or his incarnation, or his move towards the cross, his humility. Yeah, his humiliation. There you go. His humiliation, and then his exaltation, okay? But it's all, I mean, why is, I'm going to try to defend Drew's statement. Why is the phrase, be humble like Jesus, why does that capture the fullness of the passage? Yeah, and the reason is because the material underneath, including the humiliation and exaltation of Jesus, that all serves the purpose of verse 5, right? Verse 5, whatever verse 5 says, I think in this passage, that is the point of verses 5 through 11, where I do, of course, still agree that the humiliation and exaltation of Jesus are in view. That's my thought, and I think there's a reminder there that when you humble yourself, with Jesus, you'll be exalted with him too, right? Okay, so what would you guys say is the author's argument here? In a sentence. It's good. Any others? Who wants to go now? Takes a humility of Christ. Okay. Yeah. Author's argument. What was that? I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah. 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 Complete my joy, verse 2. Yeah. Okay. Shares. Okay. Okay. A mind towards unity shares the mind of Christ. Good. Or a mind towards unity takes a humility or the humility of Christ. Okay. Okay. Any others? What might capture this passage in a sentence? The argument of Paul? You said joy. Let's go back to what you said. Tom, is that right? Okay. Do you have another offering? What we can say to kind of capture joy better in this passage? Okay. So Paul just, I'm going to just do this. Paul desires to increase his joy, dot, 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 and that you would bring in what these other brothers have said, okay? Good. Yeah. Complete joy is found in a mind towards unity that shares. Excellent. Yeah. I'm going to read that together, and I want you to look at the passage. Look at the passage and then listen to the statement and see if we've captured the main claim. Okay, so we're not trying to bring in every element here. We're trying to capture the main claim and argument that Paul's making. Complete joy is found in a mind towards unity that shares the mind of Christ. Yeah. Yeah, and I would also push back on Brother Tom on that particular note as well. I don't know whether joy should be part of the main argument. I think you know this, Brother, because you just kind of imply this, but of course this is not your traditional if-then kind of statements, right? This is the implication here is since, right? Since you have all of this stuff, here's the motivation. Just getting back to what we were talking about earlier. Since this is all true of you, since you have the encouragement of Christ, since you have been comforted from His love and participate in the Spirit and have affection and sympathy, therefore, dot, dot, dot. So that's where this motivation comes into play, right? So how do we capture that motivation as we're thinking about this argument? Whoa. Okay. Okay. I agree with that, Aaron. I do think there's something going on there with the therefore and his exaltation. I don't know whether it is. I don't know whether it serves to be included in the main claim of the passage in terms of a sentence. I could be wrong. Yeah. Yes. Yes. And that's exactly it. Yeah, I was going to ask that question is, how does verse 5 relate to both his humility and his exaltation? Can you say that again one more time? Yes. That's right. That's exactly, yeah. Yeah, in Jesus' personhood and in his mindset, this is what he gave himself to, both his humiliation and his exaltation, and that should affect how we pursue unity in the church, pursue relationships in the church. Yeah. He humbled himself. Yeah. Now again, what we're trying to grasp at here is what is the big idea, the main idea that governs all of these other ideas, right, and pulls it together, including the exaltation of Jesus. It's there, right? I didn't say 2 through 1 through 8, then we wouldn't have this disagreement. I said 2:1-11. So you have to bring his exaltation into view. The question is how and why. What is the governing statement? So let's go with, just for the sake of time, let's go with this. A mind towards unity that shares the mind of Christ. It doesn't quite capture the motivation of verse 1, I get that, but let's go with that. So even if it's not there, even if exaltation's not in the statement or the motivation isn't, we're still going to talk about it. So we're going to be faithful, right? And that's okay. Looking at the primary claim of the author. So we've done structure, we've done argument, provisionally at least. I want you guys to turn to your tables and come up with a pithy argument that you will argue for your church, and then an outline, okay? So now you're preaching to your church. I want you to use lots of science and maybe a little bit of art and your creativity to come up with a argument for your church and an outline for your church. Okay, brothers, I'm excited to hear what you got. You're preaching to your church, you get to the end of your introduction, and you've got an argument that you want to prove. Let's hear some of these arguments that you want to prove based on Paul's claim in this text. Let's start on this side of the room. You guys get argument. Anybody from this side of the room? Well, I'm going to start this side of the room here. I mean, that section of tables, that's what I mean. Pretty stubborn. Yeah. It's good, brother. It's good. Okay. You had one? Comes through modeling. Okay. Good. Somebody over here? Yep. To God's exaltation. Is Paul trying to argue that the unity of the church that he's calling for leads to the exaltation of Jesus? No, I agree that that's going to happen. But my point is, Unity of the church that leads to worship. Well, let me ask these brothers. Is that what Paul is arguing in this passage? Yeah. You see that? So his exaltation is there. What you're saying is true, but I don't know whether this text is saying that. Okay? So, okay. Over here. Yep. Josh. I was bragging about you yesterday. Good. It's really good. Now, the reason I like that is because it's short and pithy, right? That's good. Anybody else? Yeah. Okay. 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 Right. Yeah, it's good. Can you, you said that, I think you said your sentence in there. I want to write it down. Okay. Aaron, you like that? That's good. That's good. Yeah. Yeah. That's good, man. I appreciate that, brother. I was waiting for some temple stuff to come in, but it's good. I'm just teasing you. We'll do that in small group time. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah. 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 Yes. Yeah. The claim might be a particular proposition or truth that he's trying to convince his readers of, or it might be a proposition and truth that he's communicating for the purpose of encouragement, which is what our brother just mentioned. And so, yeah, I appreciate your effort. I'm teasing you, but I appreciate your effort to really consider verses 9 through 11 and the context, too, which we didn't do any context work, right? For the sake of time, I'm going to show you what I had. So I preached this in 2017. This is obviously not the right answer, but I was just curious. I looked back this morning, like, what was my statement, right? And what did I do with it? Here's my statement. I said, unity lives where self-regard dies, and self-regard dies with Jesus. Okay, so just another way of trying to communicate what we're all trying to say here. There's probably strengths of that, and there's probably weaknesses of that, right? Ways that that captures what this passage says, and ways that I could have grown in 2017 in the fall. Let me hear some of your outlines, and then we're going to close it up here. So let me do one or two outlines, and we'll close it up. Okay, if that's your argument, or whatever your argument was, sermon outline from this side of the room. What do you guys get? It's an outline. Well, my points were that right there. One, and, oh, you're just being silly. Oh, okay. I thought you're like, you're good, man. You're good. Yeah, that's what I did. Those are my 2 points. I've already got a, yeah. That's funny. This side of the room, any outlines? All right, point one. What was point two? Okay. It's good. Yeah, I like that. Okay, so that would be 1 and 2, 3 and 4, 5 through 11. Okay. Interesting. Yeah, I bet. Yeah. These are the decisions we have to make. Now, I appreciate what CW did here because he's honoring Tom's point. Jeff came up to me and rebuked me on this one. Jeff was trying to defend your emphasis on joy, which I want to bring up because I think it's a good one. I mean, it's the main imperative here, right? Complete my joy. And if we're going to be true to Paul's intent, perhaps we should consider that. Joy is also a major theme in the book of Philippians, right? So, okay. I don't know whether I'm fully convinced, but I'm getting there. Yeah. So CW honored that, which is helpful. What's another outline from this side of the room? Because that's what pleases God. Yeah, the crown is a reward, not just a consequence. And so you're kind of bringing that. Okay. Good. Any other outlines? Okay. So again, we want to be ruthless, just to kind of highlight what we've done here. We want to be ruthless with not only establishing our own argument based on the claim of the author, but then as we're looking at the material of our sermon, as well as kind of these points, they all need to be connected in some way. And for me, the governing verse in this passage is verse 5, which is why I outlined it the way I did. But again, I'm challenged by some of what you guys are saying. But you want to be governed by a main idea, then everything underneath it, including points as well as material, needs to be shaped and governed by that. Let me read you something real quick, and I know I'm going over time a little bit here, but I think this is just an encouragement to me. I've got to find it in my notes here. Here we go. So just a few closing words. Jonathan Edwards, most people would say he's not a compelling speaker. And some of you probably know he wrote manuscripts, and he would just read, and he would hold a manuscript, and he would be very rigid, and he would read his manuscript. And so here's a quote by some guy who was asked if he thought Jonathan Edwards was eloquent. Okay? I want you to listen carefully to this guy. I'll try to read it carefully. He said, "If you mean by eloquent what is usually intended in our cities, he had no pretensions to it, no studied variety of the voice, no strong emphasis, scarcely ever gestured or even moved. He made no attempt by elegance of style or beauty of his pictures to gratify the taste and fascinate the imagination. But if you mean by eloquence the power of presenting an important truth with overwhelming weight of argument, with such intenseness of feeling that the whole soul of the preacher is thrown into the delivery, so that the solemn attention of the audience is riveted, then yes, he was the most eloquent man I've heard. So if you're wondering, man, I'm not naturally gifted at speaking. Work hard on getting this argument right. And work hard at getting your arrangement of the text according, that's governed by the argument, right. And perhaps the Lord, by His Spirit, will give you grace to make a significant impact in your churches, right?